Many moons ago, when the world was young and heroes walked the earth, there was born the History Podcast. And in this world, there was the Beeb. There was Lars Brownworth and a bloke called Mike Duncan, and we heard Mike and knew he was good. And so was spawned a new generation, wherein I was inspired by Robin Pearson, who picked up the mantle of the Roman Empire in Byzantium. Robin, I'm glad to say, is still going strong, is still producing magnificent history and entertainment, and here is a message from him.
Hello everyone, this is Robin Pearson from the History of Byzantium podcast. It seems like you enjoy your history recounted to you by an erudite, funny Englishman. Well, I am also an Englishman. And if you like a bit of Roman history, then come join me for a thousand-year epic of incredible highs and devastating lows. Check out the History of Byzantium wherever you get your podcasts, or go to thehistoryofbyzantium.com. For now, back to David.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of England, episode 130, Usurpation. Last week I left you all hanging onto a cliff. Just to recap, Bolingbroke had returned and quickly suborned some key royal servants, in particular Edmund, the Duke of York, and the man Richard had left as Keeper of the Realm. Now, given that Richard had taken an army to Ireland, you might be forgiven for thinking that all he had to do was come back from Ireland with said army. Sadly, nothing is that simple. Most of Richard's ships had gone away, and so he came over only with the Earls of Salisbury, Worcester, Gloucester, the Dukes of Aumale and Exeter, and a very small army. As we rejoin the story, Salisbury is in Chester trying to raise a new one. Richard is in South Wales, Bolingbroke is in control of central and eastern England, and has laid siege to Bristol, held by Courtney in the king's name. At the moment, all Henry's saying is that he wants justice and his lands back. So things were looking anything but rosy for the king. At Bristol, Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland, promised to pardon everyone who surrendered. Proud in his loyalty to the king, and confident in the loyalty of the men at his back, Courtney laughed in the face of such an offer. Ha ha! When he turned round, it was to see his men oozing out of every available orifice in the castle, gates, windows, garbage chutes, a bit like plasticine oozing out of Mr. Potato Head. Courtney immediately clarified that when he'd laughed, it had been at the very idea of anyone holding Bristol against someone as magnificent as Henry Bolingbroke, and gave himself up. Amongst others, at Bristol Henry captured John Bussy, the Speaker at the Parliament of 1397. Before long, Bussy's head was on a spike. Turns out that the wages of sin were in fact death after all. In fact, the critical moment had arrived. Henry's fingers were in every pie, and for Richard, well, I hate to keep quoting the Bible, but whatsoever a man soweth, so also shall he reap. Richard's failure to command loyalty meant he duly did not receive it. One of the men he had loved and honoured above all others was Edward, Earl of Rutland, Duke of Aumale, the son of Edmund of York. So much so that he had adopted him as his brother. In fact, Aumale was already talking to his father and to Henry. And as Richard tried to raise an army at Carmarthen in South Wales, Aumale and Worcester were planning to capture him and deliver him to his enemies. But somehow Richard found out. And so in the dead of night of the 29th of July, Richard fled, dressed as a poor priest and accompanied now only by the Dukes of Surrey and Exeter. At Carmarthen, Worcester and Aumale shed some crocodile tears, told the army to disperse, and rode to join Henry. There now followed a chase, Richard running for North Wales, and whatever army Salisbury had managed to gather at Chester, Henry following on behind with his armies, and indeed his sleeves. Richard's reunion with Salisbury was not a happy one. There was no army. The two men met at Conway Castle, and it was an emotional affair with depression, tears and despair. Richard turned to the few men remaining to him, Exeter, Salisbury and Surrey, and together they discussed next moves. Richard had no army, but he was, after all, still the king, in name at least, so they would play that card as hard as they could play it. Richard sent Exeter and Surrey to negotiate with Bolingbroke. Exeter and Surrey found Bolingbroke at Chester, which had hastily capitulated to the new power in the land. Henry had also, by this time, found the king's treasury of £46,000, which had to help. Playing ultra-reasonable, the two men airily told Bolingbroke that if he was really good and submitted to the king, then the king was, generously, prepared to be nice, and he would not have him killed, and he would allow him to have his lands back. Can't say fairer than that. The only question was whether or not Surrey and Exeter heard Henry's laughter over the sound of the dungeon door slamming shut. Henry and Northumberland held pretty much all the cards. Richard now held but one. Hated or loathe it, he was king, anointed by God. First thing for Henry in Northumberland was to get him out of the castle of Conway, which was a powerful place. So when Richard looked out of his window on the 12th of August, he saw not Exeter and Surrey returning with a deal, but the Earl of Northumberland, apparently travelling without more than just a few servants. There is more than one version of events about the discussions at Conway. They conflict a lot, and there has been much heated debate about the truth of it. But the general conclusion those historians in the end have come to really is pretty straightforward. On the one hand, there are honestly constructed, if sometimes inconsistent, records of events, and on the other, there are Lancastrian lies and propaganda. But hey, let's keep an open mind and you can judge which of these records of events at Conway is more likely. So the Lancastrian version is that Richard, with a cheerful and happy countenance, offered to give up his throne to Northumberland. Okay, got that? Happy and cheerful. The chronicler Jean Creton is slightly different. It says that Northumberland put a deal to Richard, that Richard could stay king on three conditions. One, that Bolingbroke's lands were restored to him. Two, that Richard's closest counsellors were put on trial for treason. And three, that a parliament would be summoned, with Bolingbroke presiding as steward. Here are the words of that fair and honest man, Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland. Today, by the way, we have those fine actors, Ollie and Henry.
My dear sir, my Lord of Lancaster has sent me to tell you that what he most wishes for in this world is to have peace and a good understanding with you, and greatly repents with all his heart of the displeasure he has caused you now and at other times, and asks nothing of you in this living world, save that you would please only to let him have his land, and that he may be steward of England, as his father and his predecessors have been.
Northumberland added that Richard and Bolingbroke should meet in a neutral location, namely Flint Castle, away from the danger of all their respective soldiers. Richard, Salisbury, and the other advisers remaining to him retreated to the chapel and went into a huddle. Now I'm presenting Northumberland and Bolingbroke as cheats and liars they essentially were. But I have little doubt that cheating and lying was what the situation called for. And I should also be clear that Richard was absolutely no more trustworthy. As this line delivered in the chapel would illustrate, Richard turned to his faithful advisers and said,
"It seems to me that a good peace will be made between us two, if it be as the Earl says. But in truth, whatever agreement or peace he may make with me, if I can ever get him into my power, I will cause him foully to be put to death, just as he has deserved."
So, vicious as well as simple, then. The Bishop of Carlisle, advising Richard, wanted a bit more certainty. He suggested that Northumberland should swear on the Bible that he was a fib-free zone. Northumberland did indeed so swear, and by the 15th of August, after a bit of dithering, Richard agreed to leave the castle and go to the safe, neutral and army-free Flint Castle. So which version of events would you believe in? Happy and cheerful, take my crown, it's too heavy for me, and seriously, I want you to have it. Or, Henry didn't want the crown anyway, everything will be fine, all you need to do is leave that easily defended castle and come to Flint Castle, which is in the middle of nowhere. I don't think that needs a survey monkey, do you? But basically, Richard had precious little choice, so he went with Northumberland and they rode over the hills together. Richard was in a good mood. Everything was going to be okay. Northumberland had sworn an oath. Northumberland had only 12 men with him, so he wasn't being threatened. Amazingly, it was going to be all good. Yahoy. Over a mountain they rode, and they breasted the top of the hill and looked into the valley below. What he saw knocked the good mood out of Richard. Below were the banners and streamers of a great host, Northumberland's great host, and Northumberland's great armed host. The Bishop of Carlisle was a smart cookie, and he said, "I strongly suspect that man has betrayed you." At which point, Northumberland rocked up, with butter dribbling from the corners of his mouth from all the melting going on. Stoutly, Richard acted as though he had options.
"Northumberland? If I thought that you wished to betray me, I would return to Conway right now."
It was time to come clean.
"By George, my lord, you shall not return for this month to come, for I shall conduct you to my lord, the Duke of Lancaster, as I have promised him."
By this time, Richard's companions were in floods, and Richard with them.
"Ah, my good and faithful friends, we are all betrayed, and given without cause into the hands of our enemies."
Before you could say, "blithering idiot," Richard was in Flint under close guard. The following day, Bolingbroke and Richard met. Richard put his best face on it.
"Fair cousin of Lancaster, ye are right welcome."
What he really wanted to say, of course, was that he was going to shove a sharp stick up Bolingbroke's backside, roast him on all sides, and sell him from the kebab van outside Leicester Market. In reply to this nicety, Bolingbroke was rather uncompromising.
"I have come without being summoned by you for the following reason. The common report of your people is that for the last 22 years you have governed them very badly and very rigorously, and they are not content with this. But if it please your lord, I will help you to govern better."
Richard responded with the required dishonesty.
"Fair cousin, since it pleases you, it pleases us as well."
Richard was now a prisoner, pure and simple. The party proceeded to London, among a growing sense of triumph for Henry. Richard was treated with a good deal less deference than he had been so far. With one exception, everything that happened just reinforced Henry's sense of right and triumph. Particularly important in this was the submission of London 2 days before the arrival at Westminster by the mayor and aldermen. The slightly more worrying thing was the arrival, far too late, of the Cheshire archers, who tried to spring Richard from captivity. They failed, and by all accounts didn't get close. Then, a few days later, Richard tried himself, climbing out of a window. After that, Henry kept a very close eye on him, and had him surrounded by 24 armed guards at all times. Henry's worries must have receded into the background when he arrived at London. First of all, they went to Westminster, and then, the following day, took Richard to the Tower. He was in plain view of the crowd, and the crowd wasn't friendly. London hadn't liked Richard at the best of times, and as he walked through the crowd, the insults flowed, and the plans to assassinate him proliferated. Once that was done, Henry entered the city itself by the main entrance, Aldgate. His reception could not have been more different than Richard's. God bless Lancaster! Shouted the crowd as the golden boy of the House of Lancaster entered the Cathedral of St. Paul's in full armour and knelt to pray. Henry must have been loving the whole thing. He was now pretty much up where he belonged. What we don't know is at what point he decided to make himself king. Some have argued that it was always his intention and the assurances he'd given so far out-and-out lies. Others suggest that it grew in him as his successes grew from July. I have to say that I find it very difficult indeed to believe that Henry didn't plan to make himself king from the very start. It's enormously difficult to think of any outcome from this whole situation that has Henry reinstated with all his lands and such, and happy and contented that the king isn't going to pop a kebab skewer up his backside at the first available opportunity. You've got to think that Henry at very least had the idea of making himself king in mind. Now clearly, he had to play his hand carefully. But I guess it is at least theoretically possible that it was as the crowds cheered that his mind turned to the throne and to usurpation. If it did happen that way, it was September that it may well have happened. Parliament had already been summoned for the end of the month, so now Henry and the Arundels, and indeed everyone, had to start making some decisions. What exactly were they going to do with Richard?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at UH1.com.
And even if Henry had been telling half-truths up to now, with folk like the Duke of York, the Percys and Nevilles, really it's a bit difficult to see any viable alternatives. Richard had already had a go at being managed and controlled to do a good job, and look where that had got everyone. The heir to the throne, as far as Richard had decreed, was the Duke of York and his heirs, but it was pretty clear that Edmund of Langley had no interest, and his claim was legally pretty feeble. The legal heirs by right were the Mortimers, the Earls of March, because they were descended from the next eldest of Edward III's sons after the Black Prince's line had died out, which is Richard's line. But then no one wanted a boy king. Everyone hated regencies, and the last boy king had been Richard, which was not a recommendation. So, Bolingbroke was descended in the royal line. He's a golden child. He's grown up. He's wandering around the country and everyone's cheering. He's actually conquered the place, if we're brutally honest about it. Tell me again what we're waiting for. Henry and his advisers, and a committee of learned men put together for the purpose, came up with a strategy. Now, at Doncaster, Henry had sworn not to seize the throne. Percy had sworn to Richard that Henry wouldn't seize the throne. So, given all these solemn promises, really the only way to get this done was that Richard was going to have to give the throne up himself. A bit like Edward II, though that was easier, in that he had a son to pass the crown on to, but getting Richard to step down was the essential first move, and they reckoned they could then make passing the crown to Henry stick somehow. Now again, if you read the Lancastrian Chronicles, or Lancastrian Propaganda, to give it the proper phrase, you would believe that Richard gaily and cheerfully came forward to give the throne to his cousin, quite possibly giving a little hop and click of the heels for joy as he did so. nothing could be further from the truth. For Richard, being king was the fundamental definition of his character and being. It was imprinted on his soul. It was hardware, not software. The sanctity of his anointment was indelible. No, Richard would have to be dragged, kicking and screaming, to give up the thing he valued above all else. So, Henry's hard men in negotiations on the 28th of September were his principal supporters throughout this crisis, Northumberland and Westmoreland, that is, Percy and Neville, leading a pryal of lawyers and other folk. At first, Richard held it together. He'd like to see a copy of the abdication document. The abdication document was not a comfortable read. It included a statement that said,
"I confess, acknowledge, and recognise, and from my own certain knowledge, truly admit that I have been and am entirely inadequate and unequal to the task of ruling the kingdom."
So, no hint of a praise sandwich there, then. Richard said he'd like to read it overnight, and everyone went away. I would have said it is massively unlikely that Richard spent a happy evening with his reading, and in the morning he was not in happy bunny mode, and in no way inclined to give in easily. Eventually he angrily demanded to see Henry himself. Bolingbroke duly arrived. Richard was angry, and it has to be said, played the hurt simpleton line.
"Why do you keep me guarded so closely by your men-at-arms? I wish to know, if you acknowledge me your lord and king, or what do you mean to do with me?"
As the debate proceeded, Richard got crosser and crosser, and eventually lost it.
"You have acknowledged me as your king these 22 years. How dare you use me so cruelly? I say that you behaved to me like false men, and like false traitors to your lord. And this I will prove and fight for the best of you, and this is my pledge."
And with that, Richard reportedly threw his bonnet on the ground. In my experience, it is practically impossible for anyone to look impressive while wearing a bonnet, so losing the bonnet was probably a good move on Richard's part. But nonetheless, I can't believe there wasn't the odd embarrassed cough amongst the audience, and a bit of foot shuffling, and maybe even the odd suppressed giggle from Henry, as Richard had his paddy, and as the bonnet floated groundwards. It seems unlikely anyone was going to pick up Richard's gauge. In the end, under sustained pressure, Richard broke. "Go on, then," he said, "I'll resign under certain conditions." But Henry was relentless. Resign good, conditions bad. So Richard gave in. It's one of those occasions where there are multiple accounts of how it actually happened, but the one I favour, for no particular reason, is that after he'd signed the document, we get continued self-denial. Suddenly he objected again. He couldn't renounce his appointment, he said. It was spiritual in nature, part of him. The Chief Justice gave it to him straight. "You've just resigned because you're rubbish and you're a loser." "No," replied Richard, "I'm great. It's just that my people don't love me." "No," ground on the Chief Justice, metaphorically pushing Richard's face against the spinning grindstone. "You're rubbish, and that's why your people don't love you." At which point Richard could do nothing but smile. He stepped forward and placed the crown on the ground, saying he couldn't give the throne to Henry, he could only give it to God. And so he was once again just plain old, honest-to-goodness, no-poo Richard of Bordeaux. That very evening, one of the chroniclers of the period, a chap called Adam of Usk, had supper with Richard. Richard railed against a country that had
"exiled, slain, destroyed, and ruined so many kings, so many rulers, so many great men."
Usk wrote,
"Seeing therefore the troubles of his soul, I departed, much moved at heart."
But back to the winner in all this, our Bolingbroke. His parliament in September 1399 was his crowning achievement, arf arf. The golden child became the golden king. As people arrived, the throne was draped in cloth of gold and was left vacant. A frenzy of excitement gripped Westminster and the parliament began. Richard's deposition was read out, and casually it was put out that he'd resigned cheerfully and happily, accepting that he'd been rubbish, which surely even the most credulous would have questioned, but hey. Thomas Arundel, soon to become Archbishop of Canterbury again, one of Bolingbroke's right-hand men, of course, stepped up and asked if everyone agreed that Richard was no longer king. And everyone cried out, "Yes, yes, yes." Then there was a bit of follow-up on the principle that really the best thing to do is kick a man when he's down, since that'll help make sure he doesn't get up again. So a whole bunch of articles about exactly how rubbish Richard had been, in detail, were read out. And now we come to the big bit. So, who's going to be king now then? After all, as we've said, Bolingbroke's claim was not the best. Bolingbroke and his advisers, Arundel, Northumberland, Westmoreland, had all sat late into the night discussing the tactics of the claim. They considered resurrecting some old claim that Henry's ancestor, Edmund Crouchback, had actually been an eldest, not a youngest son, so really the Lancasters should have been kings all along. But that was rejected as certifiably pence. So hey, what about the king by right of conquest thing, just like old Billy the Conk? But no, that would cause a right old kerfuffle, since then everyone's property rights would be in question. And so in the end, they just played it with a straight bat and said, "Great, my name's Henry, I'm of royal blood. God sent me to save you lot from tyranny." Now Henry's lack of clear legitimacy will bug him for many years, but at the time really almost no one wanted any other solution except Richard's nearest and dearest. So as Henry stepped up to the throne, Parliament was asked if they accepted Henry. "Yes, yes, yes," they all shouted. Then each man was asked in turn if they'd have the Duke of York. "No, no, no," they all said. "Hey, what about his son, Omar?" "No, no, no," they all said. "Or York's younger son, Richard?" "No, no, no," they all said. And so that was it. The Archbishop of York gave Henry the crown. He sat down on the throne and everyone went potty. Crowds inside and outside cheered, celebrated, and threw their hoods in the air. A few days later, on the 13th of October 1399, the official coronation went ahead in Westminster Abbey, along with a similar level of pottiness. Parliament then resumed, and rightly or wrongly, it seems to me that it's the classic example of the new man taking over in a blaze of light, hope and ignorance. Just like a modern election. The opposition boldly talk about how rubbish the previous lot have been. Complete idiots. Complete idiots. How they'll do everything better, full of hope and optimism. Full of the hope and optimism of ignorance. Then they get into power and realise that, oops, actually being in power is a sight more complicated than it looks, compromises have to be made, difficult decisions taken, and a few years later the whole thing repeats itself. Henry, a man essentially kept outside of government by Richard, promised to put everything to rights. He'd maintain the laws, he'd rescind all those terrible powers Richard had taken on himself, like automatically getting the wool subsidy, even though that would reduce Henry's income very dramatically. He would only ever levy taxation at a time of national need, none of this taxation just because it was needed to keep the lights on thing. He would not tolerate heresy. He'd rule with the advice and guidance of the great men of the realm. Plus, of course, Henry was the great chivalric knight, so he'd stick it to the Scots, who had, for the nth, and certainly not the last time, just violated a truce. He'd stick it to the French, and outdo even the great Edward III. And meanwhile, he'd be merciful. Richard would live out his life in honour. The merciful thing is a great example of Henry's hope and optimism as he took over the ship of state. Parliament sat in judgment on all the counter-appellants, and all associated with Richard's revenge Parliament. And all the signs were that they were about to be toasted. The Duke of Omar, for example, had clearly been at Richard's side throughout, had clearly sent one of his men, John Hall, to murder Gloucester. Meanwhile, the counter-appellants fell over themselves to distance themselves from Richard. "It wasn't our fault, Your Honour. We were scared. It was Richard." Hoods were constantly floating around as men challenged each other to mortal combat in defence of their honour. But at the end of it, Henry essentially let all the counter-appellants off the hook. He stripped them of their titles and lands that they'd acquired since 1397, and of course he had to do that if he was to get his own lands back and give the Arundels back their lands. But some of those counter-appellants were even given royal appointments, would you believe? So let's leave Henry Bolingbroke there, at the end of his first Parliament as King, November 1399, at the start of his reign. He's triumphant. The golden child has made good. The nation believes they have a shining hero to lead them. He has reset the glass. He's on the verge of a brilliant reign based on the old virtues and the principles of chivalry, worthy of his brilliant talents. This is the tragedy of Henry. He has no idea of just what a drag the rest of his life is going to be, seriously. How his reign will be a series of challenges, scrapes, and near misses and close shaves. The constant questions over his legitimacy, the hideous compromises he has to make in the name of survival, how his health will fail and dog him, and his powers fade, how his ultimate accolade will not be the glory of his reign, and how a new era was ushered in, but that somehow, blow after bloody and humiliating blow, he somehow managed to survive, and established a new dynasty, which will have just one brief, glorious flourish under his son. But we'll leave him there, unaware of all that, and let him celebrate for a while. I have a few donators to thank. Miles, Russell, Walter and Luke, thank you so much. I shall spend it unwisely. And thanks to all of you for listening, for all your comments on the History of England website, on iTunes and Facebook. Good luck, everyone, and have a perfectly lovely time until we meet again.